Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Good morning. We are chatting this morning with Dr. Joanne Pasalacqua from St. Vincent's Medical Center, and a good morning to you, good doctor. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, so Dr. Pasalacqua is an infectious disease specialist at St. V's and also has her own private practice. And it sounds like, Doc, you've been treating long haulers during the pandemic?
Yes, I've been treating COVID patients since the beginning of the pandemic. And certainly if we treat COVID patients, we see a good number of people with long-standing symptoms that continue on after. Long COVID is generally defined as people that have symptoms 4 to 8 weeks after their acute COVID has resolved.
Wow. What, for anyone who's not familiar, I know I've talked about long haulers from time to time on my show because I believe I was a long hauler after getting COVID the first time. For people who aren't familiar, what is a long hauler?
So by definition, it's somebody whose symptoms continue 4 to 8 weeks after having COVID. But I think the key for people to understand here is you can have severe symptoms of COVID that, you know, might land you in a hospital. But long haulers can be folks that had mild symptoms or even no symptoms when they initially had COVID. Mm-hmm. And these may be late effects of the virus that occur to somebody who had a very mild case or maybe didn't recognize that they had COVID at all. Symptoms ranging from rapid heartbeat, muscle and joint pain, sometimes dizziness on standing, problems with taste or smell. We hear about headaches that won't go away, difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping. It's a long, long list.
Mm-hmm. I know for myself, it was the kind of the concentrating. It was almost like pregnancy brain when you can't think of a something. And as a reporter, it was so hard for me to do this show for the couple of months after because I had to literally write down every question, every topic, every bullet point because I would just go blank in the middle. And I had never gone through that. And the other thing was mood swings.
Yeah.
I had never gone through like the ups and downs in my entire life. I've never experienced it, but it felt very in my face. It was very clear I was going through something for probably about 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. I mean, I think the brain fog, as patients often call it, is a common complaint. And symptoms of depression or anxiety in people that never had issues with depression or anxiety before. Yeah.
What does a long hauler look like? So in the beginning of the pandemic, we were sort of looking at this demographic of 30 to 40-year-olds, kind of on the younger side, relatively healthy, almost like athlete, surprisingly having these lingering symptoms. Has that changed?
I would say no. Interestingly, severe COVID often happens to people who are obese, people who suffer from diabetes, people who are frail and elderly, or people who are immune compromised. But the long haulers, in many cases, at least in my personal practice, many of those folks are young. I would say ages 20 to late 50s. Very often immunologically intact with, you know, maybe mild health conditions, but not things that you would expect to cause severe COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, when you talk to these folks, their case of COVID was not so severe, but it's these lingering symptoms that are giving them a hard time.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning to Dr. Joanne Pasalacqua with St. Vincent's Medical Center, an infectious disease specialist there, also has her own private practice. Now, we've been watching long haulers since the start of the pandemic, which it's hard to believe, Dr. Pasalacqua, but we are coming up on the second year anniversary of the first COVID case here in Connecticut, which was March 8th. Have we found a timeline with long haulers? So in the beginning, it was, well, this could last for 6 months to a year. This could be a couple of months. Like, do we have a more concrete idea of how long people will have these lingering COVID health issues if they are a long hauler?
You know, I think at this point, that's just not known. I know, you know, researchers are looking at SARS and MERS because those are similar viruses that, you know, happened a number of years ago. So they may provide models for what will happen with this virus, which is SARS-CoV-2. But unfortunately, I don't think we have a good understanding of how long this may last. Much depends on what the problem is. Some people get COVID and they have organ damage as a result of their COVID, and those may be permanent debilities that never go away. You know, things like damage to their heart or damage to their kidney or scarring in their lungs, people that have suffered clotting events with pulmonary emboli or heart attacks or strokes, those may be permanent deficits. But then, you know, we have people that simply can't taste or can't smell, which can be terribly debilitating. In most cases, I would say 80-some percent of the folks with difficulty with taste and smell, most of those people get better in a few weeks. There are some that end up with long-standing problems with taste and smell, often going on over months. But in my experience, at least that problem seems to go away, seems to normalize. 6-8 months later, you speak with those patients, and things have come back to normal. So it really depends on what the symptom is and what the underlying origin is. As doctors, you know, we try to look carefully over these patients to try to better understand what's driving their symptoms.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you've had any patients that are still dealing with those lingering symptoms.
Absolutely.
Even 2 years later. Wow. Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a handful of folks that I follow. Many times the symptoms are not in my realm. So, you know, if it's a lung problem, they may continue on with a pulmonologist. If it's cardiac damage, they may continue on with a cardiologist.
Wow.
But for some of these folks, the symptoms are just so broad and so nonspecific that I've, you know, continued to follow with them and try to give them guidance as to what specialists or what specialty clinics they may access in order to, you know, try to help them to recover. And there are some clinics that are specialized for that, I might add. There are now long-term COVID clinics that are popping up to try to help these folks.
We are chatting with Dr. Joanne Pasalacqua, who is an infectious disease specialist at St. Vincent's Medical Center, also has her own private practice, and since the beginning of COVID has seen so many COVID patients and has treated long haulers. Now, first and foremost, Doc, I was reading something as recent as, I think, yesterday. Doctors across the nation say about 20% of the people who test positive for COVID do become technically long haulers. Is that true?
Yes.
Wow.
I've heard ranging from 15% to 30%. So, yes,
wow.
You're right on target.
That's a fifth of the COVID patient population. That's a lot.
Yes. I think something, you know, for all of us in the medical field to be concerned about because of the size of this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned before the break, you were saying that there are clinics, almost like long hauler rehab is what I think I've heard that term before. Could you tell us just an example of like a clinic that you've recommended maybe one of your patients to go to because they were a long hauler?
The one that I've used is actually up in New Haven, affiliated with the Yale system. But Mayo Clinic, for example, has a long-haul clinic. Harvard Medical Center has a long-haul clinic. So predominantly these are large clinics. And I think for our patients locally, they can start with their primary care physician or an infectious disease specialist, and then You know, very often we utilize our specialists here in the community, but for unique or complicated cases, there are large clinics. I know the National Institutes of Health, for example, has an initiative that's looking at long haulers. So many large centers.
So are these, so I guess I'm trying to understand the clinics a little bit better. So when they go, like, are there just specialties to help with, for example, like you and I were talking about, sometimes people are kind of like unbalanced when they're walking. Are these almost like a physical therapy? Is that sort of what they're going through? Like, are they strengthening themselves? Like, what are some of the things, I guess, that they're doing?
I think these long haul clinics are occurring in large centers where they're bringing together doctors of many specialties to try to deal with the many issues that these patients have and study and learn more. It's sort of like in the early AIDS era that many patients received care locally, but then there were specialty clinics that set up, and those became sort of the powerhouses of study of these problems. So again, you know, I would say patients here in this community, you're best to start off either with your primary care physician or with an infectious disease specialist, and then from there, very often patients are referred to folks in the specialties that are needed, because we have, you know, many good specialists in this community that can help these folks, neurologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists. And we often all work together to care for the patient. But if it's something unusual, you know, an unusual presentation or a severe problem that doesn't appear to be getting better, you know, then we have these other large clinics as resources where there may be doctors of many specialties working together to look at these patients.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, the thing that trips me up, Dr. Passalacqua, is I wonder why some patients will have it for 4 months and other patients are still dealing with it two years later. Like, I wonder what makes the difference.
I mean, that's a source of intense study right now.
Yeah.
You know, in some cases, it may be an abnormal immune response, the immune system overreacting and continuing to overreact, similar to the way that people suffer from rheumatologic diseases. You know, this may be setting off an inflammatory response in the body that's just not going away. Others are looking at whether there may be some residual virus harbored in the body, more akin to diseases like HIV or Epstein-Barr virus, where, you know, when you acquire the virus, some of the virus harbors in the body, and could that be creating some of the symptoms? So that's an area of intense research right now.
Mm. Well, Dr. Joanne Passalacqua, we appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. I know there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I know on the medical front, there's a lot of work being done for long haulers, and we appreciate you being a part of it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, and we will talk to you really soon.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Welcoming back to the show, Jocelyn Hillard, who is the Regional Communications Director of the American Red Cross, overseeing Connecticut and Rhode Island, actually. And the Red Cross pops on once a month. And we're so glad to have you back, Jocelyn. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
So this month is Red Cross Month. What does that mean?
Yes, one of our favorite months of the year. So throughout the month of March, we honor people that make our life-saving mission of the Red Cross possible. And those are individuals who are turning their compassion into action and helping others during times of crisis. So what's great about Red Cross Month is it's actually an annual tradition started in 1943 when President Franklin Roosevelt issued the first Red Cross Month proclamation. So during this Red Cross Month, we challenge you to do something for your community, do something good. And with the Red Cross, you can donate, you can give blood, volunteer to help our communities, or take a life-saving class.
And tell us, Jocelyn, you know, in especially in the last 2 years, we've seen the Red Cross really struggle with the pandemic and having enough donations, and even in recent months being at a crisis level for donations. What's the latest this morning?
Thank you, Melissa. And I will say, you know, I know we come on our show monthly. We talk about the blood crisis. We talk about updates. And I do want to take this opportunity to thank everyone who has come out, rolled up their sleeves, and given over these past few months. We've seen many new donors, returning donors, and a lot of great support from your show and from our communities. So right now, you know, the Red Cross blood supply remains incredibly vulnerable, especially as doctors begin to resume elective surgeries previously delayed by the Omicron variant. So it's critical that individuals scheduled to make a blood or platelet donation are scheduling that consistently to help ensure that patients are getting the care that they need.
And we're talking this morning to Jocelyn of the American Red Cross. So, Jocelyn, how have things changed or shifted since before the pandemic? You and I have been chatting since before that happened. But in the midst of the pandemic, one of the hardest things was we saw basically every event, blood drive event, shut down because it just physically couldn't happen. It just couldn't. And over the last 2 years, they have slowly started to come back. Where are we at with donation events? Are they back to where they were prior to the pandemic? Are we still maybe at like half capacity? Like, could you tell us that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as we approached the pandemic 2 years ago, almost to the date, you know, we did have to relook at how we were collecting blood. We did momentarily have to shut down some blood drives, but the reality is that blood is a community health priority. We need to make sure that people who need life-saving blood are getting that life-saving blood, because as we know, blood cannot be manufactured. We rely on the generosity of volunteer donors to give that time to help save others. So as we've gone through the pandemic, and I will say we've had a lot of best practices that have come out of the pandemic. And one area that we've really leaned on is a lot of community partners have stepped up to host blood drives, places of worship, schools, community centers, areas that may not have held a blood drive before and have now and do consistently. We've also seen communities host blood drives perhaps in honor or in memory of someone who has needed life-saving blood. So we, you know, are always encouraging people who can give blood to give, but also think about maybe how can you help in other ways? Could that be hosting a blood drive? Could that be helping to promote and sharing out the important need of blood with your friends? So as we've gone through this pandemic, I will say, you know, over the past, we did see about a 10% decrease in donors over the course of the pandemic. And, you know, I will say here in Connecticut, we've also seen a lot of new faces show through the door. So again, we're continuing to always keep up with what our needs are here locally and how can we best meet those needs? Because remember, we're always thinking about the people who ultimately need the blood.
Mm-hmm. And Jocelyn, do you still have to go online and pre-register, or are we getting back to a new normal, if you want to call it that, where people can still show up for events? Do you have to pre-register if you want to give blood?
Yes, and that is actually one component of the pandemic that we have really leaned into. You know, as we have evaluated spacing and social distancing and mask wearing and you know, disinfectant in our blood drives, we also really rely on our blood donors to make appointments ahead of time. That way we know how many people are coming through the door, how many we can expect, and that we can accommodate. Sometimes if you don't make an appointment and come to a blood drive, we may have all of our slots full just because we are trying to keep that spacing and giving people that comfort that they need when donating. So I do strongly encourage you, if you are thinking about making a blood donation appointment, going online to redcrossblood.org, or even better, downloading the Red Cross app, the Red Cross donor app. I love it. If you're able to not only easily make an appointment in your area, but also see that blood journey as it travels from your arm to hospitals.
And Jocelyn, with blood donations, one of the biggest concerns, and I know you and I have talked about this on these calls before, but for people who are nervous of getting sick at blood donations, I feel like people have gotten the hang of being out in public with COVID. But there were sometimes in the past misconceptions, like if you contracted COVID, if you've had COVID before, if you've gotten the vaccine before, that they couldn't give blood. That's all not true, correct?
I'm not sure if I can say I need to review each one that you said, but essentially, our top priority at blood drives is the safety of our donors. And so concerning COVID, you know, if you, whether or not you've had the vaccine, with the vaccine or not, you are still eligible to donate. We just ask that if you have had a recent shot booster, that you wait, you make sure that you're feeling healthy and well. You know, if you are showing signs or symptoms of COVID, we ask that you follow the recommended CDC guidelines. Take that recommended time, whether it's 2 weeks at that time, 10 days, whatever the CDC guidance is, and make sure that you're feeling healthy, safe, and well when going to our blood drives. But there has been no known study that you can contract COVID through blood donation. So, you know, we do want you to feel safe and feel comfortable. And if you do have any of those questions, make sure that you're doing your research and visiting redcrossblood.org. I promise you there's a wealth of information there to help ease your nerves.
And again, if you want to either sign up to give blood or to be a volunteer with the Red Cross, head over to redcross.org. And again, March, marking Red Cross Month. Thank you so much, Jocelyn, for coming on this morning. We really appreciate your time.
As always, Melissa, thank you. And happy Red Cross Month, everyone.
Thank you. You too.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
Of participation from our listeners, Gary, who's a local teacher, called into the show last week. Maybe you heard him, and he asked a very good question, which was, you know, we keep extracting things from space, but how safe is it? When you look at COVID, for example, it was created in a lab, or at least that's what many people think, and we've even had the CDC said yes, and it came all the way over to the United States, the entire globe. So when you look at something coming from outer space, and a lot of times we don't even really know exactly what we're pulling, I shouldn't say that, but the general population doesn't really know what's being pulled, how do we know how safe it is? Are we protecting the Earth as well as we can? So I tossed that question over to David Mestre because I thought, well, you would know. So David Mestre is here this morning talking about planetary protection. So good morning, David. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, this is actually something that we've been thinking about for a very long time. In fact, people have been, or scientists and people that are in the space exploration, even as far back as the 1950s, we were concerned about contaminating the space environment. Mm-hmm. We call this forward contamination, where, you know, we accidentally contaminate a very fragile ecosystem that we may not know about out in the solar system. And then we're also concerned about what's called backward contamination, where, we brought something accidentally from the solar system to us.
Right.
Maybe some kind of extraterrestrial life we don't know about, or a molecule, a bioactive molecule, a prion, infectious protein, who knows?
Or even an invasive species. Like, we see that happen from country to country, where invasive species, you know, like the ash borer, for example, destroying our trees. That wasn't originally here, you know?
Yeah. And so those are things that we've been really kind of concerned about. And so what happened is that, over time, we actually started creating this international body of scientists, the Committee of Space Research, actually created a set of policies of, you know, this is what we need to do to be able to protect these pristine environments and also to protect our planet. And so they kind of fall under this kind of blanket set of policies called the Planetary Protection policies.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. So it turns out that there's actually, you know, groups that come around and they get together and they actually share best practices of how we can actually, sterilize our equipment and try to protect our solar system exploration from contaminating other bodies. And so there's actually NASA takes this so seriously that they actually have a planetary protection officer.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Yes. So this is Dr. J. Nick Bernardini, and he's part of NASA agency, and this NASA agency is kind of like they call it the Office of Safety and Mission Assurance, great acronym, OSMA, not to confuse with OSHA. And what they do is they're in charge of making sure that protocols are followed. So you can't go into space until you've actually followed all the proper protocols, depending on the type of mission that you're going to be conducting. So if you're just going to fly by Mars, you know, you may not need a certain level of protection. But if you're going to land on Mars, or if you're going to bring back stuff from Mars, then maybe you need to follow certain protocols to be able to keep us safe and then keep Mars safe as well.
How do you become like the planetary protection officer? How do you, what background do you have to have? Are you somebody who was like part of a health department that made sure restaurants are clear? You know what I mean? Like, what is your protocol, to get that job?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, seriously. How do you get this job?
Right.
This is a pretty good gig here. So his background is actually in microbiology. So it's actually kind of close.
That makes more sense.
And that kind of tells us that, where we're thinking. We're not thinking like an invasive species. Yeah, we're not, there's no zebra mussel that's going to be coming, from Mars to Earth. At least we don't know that. But what we think might be happening is that there may be environments out there in space that could be conducive to life. That Mars, maybe, or maybe there might have been some past life. But we're looking at places like, some of the moons of Jupiter, like Europa, where we see water underneath the ice.
Right.
Enceladus, there's liquid water, and there's geysers that are spewing this water out into space. So somewhere underneath that ice, there's liquid water. And we think that if there's liquid water, there's a really good chance that there might be something alive, because something is warming that water to the, to keep it liquid.
Right.
It's got to be the right temperature.
Right.
And we found that where there's even a drop of water anywhere, there's a good chance for life. So we're not mining that. And so what happens is that, we're now in a different world. We're now in a different era in terms of space exploration. Before, you needed to be a government with massive amounts of tax dollar money to be able to do this kind of exploration. Now, we got private companies in the mix, like a SpaceX. And so, there's been talk for some time about actually going and picking up an asteroid and mining it and bringing that stuff back to Earth. And so before, nobody really took it seriously because it's just so expensive. I mean, it'll cost more just to build all the technology to get the materials than what you could possibly get from the materials themselves.
Wow. Wow.
And so nobody took that seriously. But now that may be changing. And so what's going to protect us from a private company doing things that, maybe they're going to take some shortcuts. Maybe they're not going to, because profit is part of that margin. So,
sure.
So we do have a treaty, it's called the Outer Space Treaty,
we need that. Seriously, because you never know if there's some yutz out there who doesn't care.
Yeah,
and they
yeah,
just,
and,
you know, they want their own agenda. They have their own agenda.
Yeah, and so it turns out that if you're one of these yucks, who's responsible if you do something that's harmful to us?
Right.
Well, the country that you're in. So if one of these, companies does something that's highly suspect or dangerous, and that company happens to be in the United States, well, United States laws may be involved. So that's Outer Space Treaty, which was signed back in 1967, says, okay, which nation is responsible when we do things that are wrong? That's the nation that you're in. Okay, so you're the one that's going to be responsible. But even in the Outer Space Treaty, there was a section on planetary protection. So in 1967, we're thinking about planetary protection, that we need to protect our planet, and we also have to protect all the fragile ecosystems that we might find out there in the solar system.
Yeah, it's so true. It's not just us. It's also what are we bringing out there. And David, I so appreciate you presenting this. As I mentioned, I love when we get listener engagement and when they have specific questions. And I thought this was pretty dynamite. I loved this concept. So thank you for diving into this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. You know, maybe some listeners out there that are lawyers that may be thinking about, hey, I could probably go into space law.
There you go.
Or business, because those are going to be important. But
yeah.
I think, you know, in terms of planetary protection, that's sort of a kind of bureaucratic kind of term. I think we should call it Guardians of the Galaxy.
I mean, I think Disney would be mad, but I'm okay with it. I'm great with it. I think as long as you don't walk around saying I am Groot over and over, you should be okay. So.
Yeah, I think we're good. I mean, we just got to have to elevate the whole, you know, maybe you don't have to be like somebody with the health department in microbiology. You know, maybe some other superpowers.
Listen, I think Buzz Lightyear could do the job just fine. I'm just saying.
I think so, too.
Saying. All right. David Mestre, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Take care.
Thank you.